Welcome back to Adelaide's Festival of Ideas and to Late Night Live. Well, the world has no shortage of radicals, whether religious or political, all confident about their right to express themselves however they choose. But is the world actually a bit short of revolutionaries? Today's guest argues that if you take the life of Joan of Arc as an example, putting aside the various ways in which she's been cast as a hero and a martyr, she's a very useful muse as a true radical. Dr. Ali Alazadeh is a Melbourne writer of fiction, poetry, non-fiction, literary criticism. He's a lecturer in creative writing and literary studies at Monash, and his latest book is called The Last Days of Joan of Arc, and it'll be published next year. You argue that the contemporary individual is too caught up in the anxieties of identity to become a genuine agent of change. The anxieties of identity.
Yeah, definitely. Look, I was just before, when people said they couldn't hear you, I was hoping that they hadn't heard that question. So, because it is a very controversial question. People, other speakers at writers' events and so on have been... Now, is that the term non-platformed? Is that what it's called? When people who disagree with them, they just get up and leave. Because they have said things that are long to do with identity that people don't like hearing. And some of these people who are kind of assuming these roles of activism proclaim to be on the left, apparently. I'm not sure if the left really is about being intolerant towards other people's point of view, especially around the question of identity. Now, identity is a very modern phenomenon. It's of course socially constructed, you know, such as gender identity or national identity. No one has an Australian or French or Iranian gene. You know, it's something that we become later as we grow up. So national identity, gender identity, and so on, they're clearly sort of culturally constructed. But what worries me today is that on top of it, in order, I guess, to address some of the anxieties about how culturally and socially constructed it is, how artificial all of this is, we now are going, returning to the biological, or to some kind of a biological determinism, to talk about racial identity and gender identity and even sexual identity and so on, or to do with ability or disability or age or whatever, as though it is completely posited in our bodies. Now, that to me is a very dangerous direction to go, especially for those of us who want to be on the left, who want to transform society. And myself, I think that true revolution will have to be a universalist phenomenon that brings us together. So to me, identity, the notion of identity, has a whole range of philosophical problems and biological determinism, but ultimately it divides people. It doesn't result in solidarity and unity.
How does Joan head us in the right direction?
Well, that's a great thing. I think that she, her story, her general outline of the story is quite well known.
Don't hesitate to repeat it.
Okay, great. I'd love to talk about it. So I'll just in terms of the context, she happens in the context of the longest war in human history, the so-called Hundred Years' War, which is not just a war between France and England, although that's how it's remembered primarily in an Anglophone country like Australia because of the cultural significance of Shakespeare and Co. and Henry V, the Battle of Agincourt, and so on. But it's actually longer than 100 years, and it involves just about all of Western Europe in some capacity. So, for example, the Italian bankers, the burgeoning new bourgeois centres in Italy are involved. They're betting money on the English. The Flemish especially are involved. The new sort of burgeoning mercantile industrial and capitalist powers are involved as well. It is a war that involves everybody. And nation states as such, of course, don't exist. There is no such a thing as a quote-unquote France. There is a kingdom of France, but that's a very loose amalgam of duchies. At times they submit to the king, at times they don't. Jeanne herself... is an important element in constructing the notion of the nation state, which is yet to come. She is, if you like, a nationalist, but I would say that she's what we would call a civic nationalist, somebody who believes in the notion of a centralized sovereign power in order to protect the people, especially the peasantry, from war, pillage, brigands, and the dukes and the warring feudal powers.
How does she happen?
Excellent question. I think, for one thing, I would say, I mean, everything we know about her seems so unlikely and unusual that there are a number of conspiracy theories. And they're pretty intriguing, you know. I think you have some interest in them. Conspiracy theories in general, they try to rationalize, but at the same time, they're completely off the mark. So one of them is that she's actually the bastard daughter of the Royal House of France, that she's actually the sister of the king that she will later proclaim, and that she doesn't get burnt at the stake anyway. You know, so another woman gets burnt in her place. She goes on to get married and have children. It's pretty crazy, but, you know, you can kind of see that they say, look, how did, could this absolutely unlikely event happen? How
well, of course, there are parallels with Jesus, who, as we all know, got married and ended up living in India.
India, is it? Right, okay. Yep. I mean, who knows where? Maybe Jean ended up in Australia somehow. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, that's the conspiracy theory. Mm. What's yours?
My conspiracy theory is actually that the basic accounts are correct. That she is a peasant woman who's born in a village of Domremy, possibly in 1412. Probably not necessarily on the night of Epiphany, which is what the tradition tells us. I think that's too good to be true for her to have been born on that sort of important day of the Christian calendar. She is the village itself is on the border between two duchies, the Duchy of Lorraine and the Duchy of Bar. Her political affinity is with the French royal house Valois, because that's where her village is. However, within the village, there are people who support the other side, which is the Duchy of Burgundy, and that's who the English are allied with. She is an ordinary girl. Her family are their tenant farmers. They're free farmers. That is to say, they're not serfs anymore. Serfdom has been abolished in France at this point. But they nevertheless don't own the land they work on. They own their own house, but they have to work on the land of the dukes. So the dukes, in return, let them keep some of their product, but extract bulk of it as a form of kind of exploitation, and that's how the nobles live. They live off the work of others, and that hasn't changed. That's still the case today. So little by little, I'm going to tease out the similarities between her time and ours. But clearly, the fact that the overwhelming majority of people work for others is a kind of something that hasn't changed from late Middle Ages to today. We know that something happens to her when she's around 13. She hears the so-called voices, and we can talk more about that later. But that over the next three or four years, she gets compelled by her voices to leave her village, to basically run away from home, and to go and see the captain of a nearby fortress called Robert de Bauricourt, and convinces him to send her to meet the king, who is the French king, who is now being besieged and is about to be toppled by the English and the Burgundians. And when she arrives there, she is wearing the clothes of a man. She is disguised as a man for the journey, but she hangs on to her masculine outfit, and she repeats to the king of the French, the Charles. She says, "I've heard voices. I'm here to expel the English, end the war, and explicitly end the great misery of France."
It beats Cinderella, doesn't it?
I think so. I mean, but there's that transformation element there. I mean, you're absolutely, it's so similar in a way that we have this sort of peasant girl who becomes a knight for a period and has to put on special outfit. And there's a supernatural element in common with Cinderella.
Well, here we are sitting in the 21st century when the mighty armies of the West are still very reluctant to allow women into the ranks, let alone into senior roles. And one of the gobsmacking aspects of this is a young woman becomes, the heavy.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing. I mean, this is the sort of, I guess, the answer to the question about how does she break with identity. I mean, she breaks with that in a strong way by saying that, yes, she at no point denies the fact that she's biologically a woman. The title she chooses for herself is La Pucelle, which doesn't really have an equivalent in English, but maybe the maid is one, but a young maid, a young virgin. So it's very, very feminine. You can only be a female Pucelle. But at the same time, she is sort of blocking or breaking with her identity as a woman through her clothes that she wears, through this title. I mean, Pucelle is not, you know, a woman who doesn't become a woman who doesn't, you know, get married and have children, which was what women did in late Middle Ages primarily, unless there were nuns.
100 Years' War. We now live in an era of history was, when the various narratives are bitterly contested. And we all know of examples in Australia. I have a feeling that she's also contested, that various sides of politics claim her as their own.
Ah, big time, big time. I mean, in France, definitely. But it's also interestingly, she's kind of entered Australia as well. You know, there's a big statue of her outside of the Melbourne State Library, which has always struck me as curious. And I found out recently that it was a controversial decision to have made in early 20th century to put her statue there, because at the time, France was still sort of seen as an enemy of the British Empire. But luckily for everyone, the Great War happened and they joined forces. So the French became good. But it was kind of controversial. I think in France itself, I mean, she's gone from basically... So she's... You know, after her amazing sort of military campaign, she's arrested by the Burgundians and the English. She's charged with heresy. They eventually manage to find her guilty of heresy. They burn her. For about 20 years, she's a non-person. Nobody wants to touch her. It's kind of the charge of heresy back then is a very serious charge, perhaps a bit like terrorism or pedophilia today. Once you're stuck with it, you're tainted. So the king has to stage an elaborate trial of rehabilitation 20 years later, around 20 years later, when they've kicked the English out and Rouen, the capital of Normandy, which is where Jeanne was burnt, has been recaptured by the French. They have have a retrial. They bring people from her childhood, the soldiers who fought with her, the judges who sentenced her to death. It's a massive source of information about her. That's the reason we know so much about her, are the testimonies of people in the trial of rehabilitation. And they sort of rehabilitate her. They prove that, no, she was not a heretic. Little by little, she becomes a sort of a saintly figure that justifies the French ruler's divine right to rule, because she's a Christian, even though she's burnt by the church. And she gives the king the sort of an aura of sanctity. Until the French Revolution, the French revolutionaries are very split about her, because they're absolutely against clergy and monarchy, but she's a peasant warrior. So how do you reconcile that? During the French Revolution, the first wave of French revolutionaries, they de-Christianize her, they burn her relics. They completely say she's a relic of monarchy. We don't want to have anything to do with her. Early 19th century, especially the historian Jules Michelet, who was a Republican, reclaims her. And he says, look at the documents. What we find in there is not a royalist, but we find a brave, ordinary peasant girl, a hero of the people, who fights for what she really believes in. And that sort of takes her back to the left. But that contestation between left and right, especially the far right today in France, the, you know, proto-fascists of the Front National, they've reclaimed her. Le Pen, you know, Marine Le Pen always carries her flag everywhere she goes. Yeah.
There are many fine writers and a couple of filmmakers at least who've embraced her. You mentioned elsewhere the Mary Gordon biography, Marina Warner's very good study of Joan of Arc. There was the Dreyer film, and more recently, an American director starred Gene Seberg in the role. Yeah. Oh, and of course, I'm forgetting George Bernard Shaw.
Yes, yes.
But they all use her for different purposes.
Definitely. I mean, I really love Bernard Shaw, and that's sort of early 20th century, and I think that's has something in common with the Carl Dreyer movie, where they sort of see her as a naive but innocent Christian woman who's being tormented and bullied and ultimately murdered by a patriarchal clergy. And they both kind of have this view, but that's happened precisely at the time where she's canonized. So the far right in France finally managed to convince the Vatican, I think there might be bribery involved, I'm not sure, to saint her, to canonize her. And when she is made a saint, they have this response from people from the left, like Bernard Shaw and Dreyer, who say, actually, she was a victim of the church.
Our guest is Ali Alizadeh, a Melbourne writer of fiction, poetry, non-fiction, literary criticism. As a writer, what about the quality of her prose?
Of Jeanne's statements. Well, that's a really
good
question.
Quite a bit is recorded.
Yeah. Oh, look. I mean, she's not. She's a silent and strong type. I would say. I think she's a woman of few words. When she assumes the role as a soldier and knight, she really takes to it. She's a very tough kind of person. She doesn't like to express herself in words. When people force her to speak about her voices, for example, she gets very irate. It's very personal. She doesn't want to talk about it. The few things she does say to reflect a sort of figurative and allegorical way of speaking at the time. So, for example, about the voices or seeing an angel or receiving a sign, it could be that she's speaking figuratively. I don't really think, personally, that she actually heard voices. I don't think her eardrums reverberated. You know, there's a lot of question of what her voices were. My view is that they were the voices in her head for sure. She really believed in them. I'm confident she saw the angels. She was a very devout Christian. These are real things to her.
And of course, these days we tend to retrospectively diagnose many saints and their voices as being schizophrenics, yeah. But you detect no sign of mental illness?
Not at all, not at all. I mean that's... I have no bias against mental illnesses at all, but when we look at what Jeanne does, especially when she arrives in the historical scene, you know, she's allowed to, at first she's just a flag bearer for the army. She's just this young, you know, spiritual woman who's supposed to inspire the soldiers to go and die for God, basically. But when she arrives in the battlefield, she changes her mind. She says, no, I want to lead the soldiers. She probably sees how pathetic the generals of the French army are, and they are completely being routed by the English. And she says, well, why don't you do this differently? And she throws herself into the battle. From then onwards, she leads the French army. Her strategies, the way she conducts herself, are completely 100% rational and extremely intelligent. I would go as far as saying she's some sort of a military genius, which might seem counterintuitive. You know, how could an 18-year-old girl be a military genius? But she proves herself in that way. She completely turns the course of the Hundred Years' War. She routs the English time and again.
Did Napoleon ever cite her? Did he embrace her as a part
of
his mythology?
No, Napoleon was a misogynist. He could not have had anything to do, unfortunately. I mean, no, he rehabilitates. Napoleon, after the French Revolution, rehabilitates her, but for his own purposes. He's more interested in her image as a militaristic figurehead and a patriotic woman.
I'm now going to invite the audience to pose questions or raise arguments, and the microphone is right there in the middle. And please use the opportunity. And whilst you do so, let's go back to the starting point. Why do you think that she is such an important figure for in the 21st century revolutionary context?
Yeah, I mean, she's amazing. Everything I've said kind of makes it clear she's so rare in her own late medieval context. But for us today, I think, I just feel like we are so incapacitated by our fears, by our anxieties, by our ideological constraints, and somebody who will bravely say, I have heard voices, and I believe in their truth, and I'm prepared to fight and sacrifice myself for them, and I'm prepared to break with my identity. I'm not going to sort of like, you know, dwell on how victimized I am. I'm actually going to take the fight to the enemy. And I'm going to embrace a universal cause. I'm going to fight for everyone. I think the universality of Jeanne, which comes from Christian universality, is something we can all learn from. A lot of us on the left now think, oh, no, universalism is bad. We're all particularists. You know, we all believe in small little things, pockets of resistance. No, Jeanne said, this is a war. We fight for everybody. And along the way, she keeps saying, she even writes to a big enemy, Duke of Burgundy. She says, look, if you stop fighting us, you can join me. We can all come together. All she wants is a lasting peace, in her own words, and an end to the misery of France. She fights for everybody.
So she's not into factions, she's into unification.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Madam. Yeah.
Hi, Ali. My name's Evie. When I was in my 30s, I think, I first heard the story of Joan of Arc. I was doing a course, I can't remember what it was about, and the teacher was a Catholic priest. Mm. And anyway, he sort of was talking about it, and I've always kind of like, I don't know, just kind of bonded with the story, and it inspired me. That's why I came to the talk. But he talked a lot about the tutor, about the rage and anger, because, like, I'm not a history buff, but I know that things were not right, and she saw a lot of wrong and, you know, all the things that were happening in her country. So it was the rage he talked about, which I kind of understand. Do you think it's the same? That was one of the things that moved her, other than like being called to it. I guess in the religious way that a lot of saints had visions and had callings and, you know, not just hearing voices but other things too. So I kind of get that. But it's more about the that being one of the motivating factors to make her sort of take action.
Absolutely. I mean, totally. I mean, this is a horrific war, 100 years of war. You know, in Normandy during the war, the population declines by a third. A third of the population die. In one English siege of the city of Rouen alone, 40,000 out of the 60,000 inhabitants of the city die. I mean, this is an absolutely brutal war. You might even want to call it a bit genocidal, but I don't use that term. So, of course, if you're a peasant woman during this period and, you know, I mean, peasants are at the mercy of pillagers and raiders anyway, but if you're a young woman, you're particularly victimized. Absolutely, you're going to have a lot of rage and anger. Just before she leaves her village, a number of things happen. One of them is that her village is attacked by the enemy camp and is burnt. The village church in particular is destroyed. This is a site that she was very fond of, so she would have been outraged about that. She was being forced to marry. Her parents had arranged a marriage for her. She rejects it, and she goes and stands in front of a judge, and she says, "No, I refuse to marry this person my parents have chosen for me." And at the same time, she meets another woman. We don't know much about her. I've speculated a lot about her, a woman called Larousse, the redhead. And anyway, these things happen simultaneously, and after that, she leaves the village to go and fight. I think something happens at that time, and this is when the voices start telling her that, look, we don't just want you to be chaste and virtuous, we want you to go and change the world. And so something happens there. I think rage and anger definitely is a part of it, but I think there's also courage and the belief that you have encountered truth and you're prepared to fight for it and die for it. For the betterment of mankind. And that's really important, the last part, because she's not just fighting for her community and so on. That really makes all the difference for me, because that's what gives it the righteousness. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you, Ali.
Quite a lot of transformational figures in the latter part of the 20th century come rushing to mind. Do any of them have parallels to Joan of Arc? I'm thinking, say, of Mandela.
Possibly. I mean, one of the things about
unifying figures,
rather than
factional.
Absolutely. No, in that sense, definitely. Yes, definitely. I mean, the thing is that she ultimately, during her own lifetime, fails. You know, after amazing victories, she fails to bring all the factions together. She goes to Paris, which is under Anglo-Burgundian control, but she's repelled. They basically say, no, you are a heretic. The English genuinely believe she's a witch. You know, they're not just being ideological. They really think she's a witch. How else could a woman have defeated the mightiest army in Western Europe? So that she must be a witch. She's a threat to their masculinity and so on as well. So she couldn't succeed during her own lifetime to be a unifying figure. But I think in terms of contemporary figures, I'm really sorry I don't remember her name, but this is a Kurdish fighter from the Women's Brigade in the Peshmergas. And you know, her story I just saw a few weeks ago, and it really saddened me. She's 19. She was 19. She personally, she was a sniper. She killed many of these ISIS fighters. And a few weeks ago, the ISIS caught her and beheaded her. And I just thought that, wow, this is the sorts of parallels that I really like. They are, you know, they sort of correspond. I think today in France, Marine Le Pen is trying to say, I am the new Jeanne d'Arc. And that's an absolute falsehood. I think that Kurdish girl is much more, and I'm sorry I don't remember her name. If somebody does, the Western media is referring to her as the Angelina Jolie of Kurdish resistance, which is utterly humiliating to reduce her to her, you know, feminine beauty. But I think,
And there are no connections, of course, with the Gandhian tradition.
Gandhi, I would say probably not. If we understand Gandhi as non-violence, as some kind of a pacifist sort of hippie thing. There's been new theorizing about nonviolence by, say, Howard Cagle, and I think that it is actually nonviolent was quite violent in its own way. But Jeanne is definitely a warrior. I mean, she is not she's not afraid to lose her own life, but she will take lives along the way.
I found some writing of yours here, which I want to share with the audience. Quote, I find it fascinating that some of the least memorable literary depictions of Joan have been offered by some of the world's best-known writers Shakespeare, Voltaire, Schiller, Mark Twain, and many an acclaimed writer has failed to produce a version of the famous woman's life that has stood the test of time. And here you remind me of something that I had completely forgotten. Thomas Keneally's 1974 novel, Blood of Red, Sister Rose, is one of the Booker Prize winners' least known novels. Yeah,
it's out of print now, which is unusual considering the famous subject matter, the famous author. I think genre is too complex. I mean, everything I've said, this is, by the way, the result of 20 years of research and thinking to even get to the point where I can describe a bit her personality. She's very complex, but I think she's been the mercy of so many ideological, misappropriations that, if you like, the true genre has become really obscure. Shakespeare's account is, because very partisan, of course, he's writing during the Renaissance, the English still think she's a witch, but it is so bad that Shakespeare scholars say that he probably didn't write it, or he probably didn't write, he only wrote half of it.
Madam, your turn.
I'm not a historian or a philosopher. However, I do know in contemporary times that women's contributions are often overwritten. Like, take Wikipedia, for example. It's mostly written by men, and there's a huge feminist push to actually put the contributions of women in there. I assume that the rest of history is actually the same. And there were a lot of feminist scholars in the 70s and 80s who started to dig up the women who did contribute to Fields. And then that, you know, as feminism became a dirty word, it sort of died down a little. Well, a dirty word in some circles, I should say. If Joan had been a boy, would anyone have thought it was miraculous, really? I guess I'm watching Game of Thrones all the time and all the women are leaders and, you know, it's fantastic. But I'm sure that women's place in public life is not as small or insignificant as we would think today. I'm sure that it's more a case of women being written out of history because that hasn't been women's role to record themselves.
Yeah, thanks. Great question. I mean, I think among the historians of this period of French history, the role of women definitely has not been written out. This is the mainstream historical view that at this period, the two most powerful people in France are women, Isabella of Bavaria and Yolande d'Anjou. So they certainly haven't. Jeanne's being a woman is absolutely central, particularly in rousing men to fight for her. I mean, there is an element there, especially in the actual battles, that she's a daredevil. She throws herself in harm's way. She's wounded repeatedly. And when her soldiers see that she's braver than them, she's getting hurt, she's about to be killed by the English, they throw themselves into battle. And so definitely her gender is a very major part of the story. And at that period, there were a lot of very powerful women in France. None of them fighting hand-to-hand combat, I should say, though. Yeah.
You concede that Shaw's version of Joan is probably the most enduring literary interpretation. He sort of reclaims her for humanism, doesn't he?
Definitely, yeah, absolutely. And you know, that to me is a very convincing way to present her. I mean, I think she is a religious person. She was deeply religious herself. One of the most painful experiences she has during her very long imprisonment, which results in her being burnt at the stake, is that she's not allowed to see a confessor and she's not allowed to receive the Eucharist, and that really breaks her heart. Just before her death, two priests go out of their way to make it happen, and they finally, you know, have her receive communion before she's burnt. So she's certainly in herself not an atheist, although there was no atheism back at that time. But nevertheless, the story, the fact that she is so much in contradiction with the values and teachings of the church at that time, especially her cross-dressing, that was absolutely scandalous. That's the thing, ultimately, they got her for. They couldn't prove that her voices were satanic. They couldn't prove that she was a heretic. They couldn't prove that she was blaspheming or committing, you know.
But they found her guilty of a fashion crime.
Fashion, yeah. I mean, then she became very fashionable. You know, women's short hair in 20th century as a hairstyle is inspired by her.
Yes, from the passion of Joan to the fashion of
the
Joan.
Fashion of
Sorry, they'll have to use the microphone, and I wish you would, sir. We've got time for one more question.
One of the things that I thought about as you were speaking was that there were two books that the German soldiers were given in World War I. One was the Bible, and the other was, would you believe, Nietzsche's Thus Spake Zarathustra. And I guess as I was listening to what you were saying, I was reflecting on the question of who do we want as heroes. You certainly can't think of any... I certainly can't think of anything more, anyone more from another planet than Joan of Arc. She's such an extraordinary woman. And so, of course, someone who's well made to become a hero and to capture our imagination. But I wonder whether that's necessarily going to be such a great thing in politics. As a source of political inspiration. I can certainly see the ways that she is, but it's such an explosive icon of political action that it scrambles scrambles my mind. Thank you.
No, that's a really good question. I guess something I'm saying is that it's not her politics as such we should be getting inspired by. I mean, there are politics of another stage in history, you know. She was in favour of centralised monarchical governments and so on for very specific reasons to do with her time. So I'm not saying they should inspire us, our authoritarianism of any kind, for example, or royalism. I mean there's still a faction of royalists in France after 220 years. They still want to resurrect monarchy. They cling on to her obstinately. So I'm not saying we should... use/abuse her for those reasons. But I think it is the form of her action, it is her personality, it is her subjectivity, it is the fact that she does universalize her own particularity, say, or she breaks with limitations of identity to fight for humanity. Those are the things that I think are very inspiring, and I think that they could certainly break us out of the deadlock of having to vote for one scumbag versus another scumbag. I really do think that if we feel as individuals, as subjects, empowered to go and want to change the world, to want to end the misery of our world, that I think is a much better thing than having to choose between Trump and Clinton, to be honest.
Yes, sir.
Hello, my name's Alastair. My question is, you've just talked about all these great authors and writers who've written books about Joan of Arc, and you yourself has now written a book about Joan of Arc. My question is, what are you hoping to tell people in the 21st century about Joan of Arc, and when did you first come into contact with her, and what inspired you to write something? Like, are you...
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's a big question for any writer to ask. You know, why another one? Why add one of them? Is as Philip mentioned, is my absolutely sort of arrogant view that nobody else has got it right, maybe with the exception of Bernard Shaw, and I'm going to get it right. So that's one. She's a genuine aesthetic poetic challenge. You know, she's like a really difficult piece of piano music that to prove that you're really great, can you play this piece by, I don't know, Rachmaninoff or whatever. So as a writer, she is a genuine challenge to see if you can get the facts of her life right and still construct a character and all of it to be believable. And even sympathetic. That's really hard. So that's what I've really tried to do. But I mean, I have a really deep personal connection. When I was a child, I was influenced by her image. And I think that's what it's about.
Well, we'll check out the results next year when your book finally appears. Thank you. Thank you, Ali. Ali is a Melbourne writer of fiction, poetry, non-fiction and literary criticism, currently a lecturer in creative writing and literary studies at Monash. A pleasure and a privilege.
Thank you. Thank you both.